Okay, welcome to clarifying the Sage's Intent discussion group, and we'll start with the refuge prayer. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, for the virtuous merits I collect by the practice of giving and the other professions. May I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other professions. May I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections. May I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratnamandala Puja Mega Samundra Saparana Samaya. Okay. So just to remind you, we are reading Apai Rinpoche's commentary on Sakyapandita's Clarifying the Sage's Intent. And there'll be a few additional comments from the actual text itself. Clarifying the Sage's Intent by Sakyapandita. And we'll be reading and commenting and discussing the eighth chapter, which is the perfection of meditative concentration. But just to remind people a little bit about this text, which is, I think, a very important text, especially in the Sakya tradition. Sakyapandita was born in 1182 and did his Parinirvana in 1251. He wrote this text towards the end of his life and taught it extensively, more than any other teaching. And there's different ways of categorizing texts. There are sutras, which are the Buddha's words, and then there are the shastras, which are the commentaries that have been accumulated over the centuries by great sages, which go to great lengths to explain the sutras and also to collect the topics under one heading, because sometimes the sutras, the Buddha taught the same topic in different teachings, and so the topics spread out in different sutras, and the shastras combine them in one convenient place where you can go and read and study a particular topic. And then a third category of texts are the practice manuals. So how do you do it? How do you do the practice? And Clarifying the Sage's Intent falls into that category. It is a practice manual. So it's the map from before you become a Buddhist all the way through your practice until enlightenment. And so it's sort of a roadmap for practitioners. And it's also like a GPS, because it tells you if you get off the track and how to get back on the path. So it also lists the various hazards, so to speak. So for anyone who's really interested in knowing and practicing the Dharma, I think this is a really valuable text. And also Sakyapandita, of course, himself was a great scholar, but he was also a great practitioner too. So that's one of the reasons that that we study this text. The commentary, on the other hand, by Ape Rinpoche is really useful because it sort of simplifies the text for us and makes it very readable, and there's stories in here that illustrate the various points in the original text, in the root text. And so this is a very handy book to use also. It's very readable, it's fairly short, and it's immediately applicable. So that's a little bit of background about the text itself, clarifying the sage's intent. The book starts out, the first chapter is about, before you actually become a Buddha, what are spiritual propensities, what is Buddha nature, and how do some people end up on the path and some people don't, and so on. The second chapter is about going for refuge, which is after you've decided, okay, I'm going to do this path, how do I get on the path and start to practice? And that's refuge. And then the next six chapters are the actual practice itself, which are the six perfections. And we've covered four of those perfections up till now. And the fifth one, which is the perfection of meditative concentration, is the eighth chapter in the book, and I've posted the website where you can order the text from if you're interested in following along. It's much cheaper to order it directly from the publisher rather than going online from a bookseller. So that's a little bit of background, and we have some readers here tonight that are going to help read the text. So which one of you would like to start? Okay.
I'll start.
Okay.
So, chapter 8, the perfection of meditative concentration. The fifth of the six perfections is the perfection of meditative concentration. Meditative concentration refers to a mental state abiding one-pointedly on a single virtuous object. After discursive thoughts have been pacified, when this state of concentration is motivated by the Mahayana enlightenment thought and associated with the correct realization of ultimate reality, it becomes the perfection of concentration. On the other hand, if through our mind may be concentrated one-pointedly, if we meditate on the wrong view, for example, the views of other philosophies or religions, we won't achieve the main objective of our practice. If we seek a result only for this life, or seek only our own personal liberation, and even if we meditate in the correct manner, with the proper understanding of the procedure, it will not be the perfection of meditative concentration.
Okay, so this perfection, just like all the other ones which preceded this one, Ape Rinpoche goes and points out that we're talking about the perfection of meditation, not just meditation. There's all kinds of meditations. Lots of people do meditation, different types. But this is a very particular topic, which is the perfection of meditation in the Mahayana tradition or on the Mahayana path. So it isn't just meditating, but it's meditating also with two other conditions, one of which is our motivation needs to be a bodhisattva or a Mahayana motivation. That is, we're doing this practice for the benefit of all sentient beings. And the other thing is it has to be conjoined with the understanding and application of emptiness. So those two additional factors are necessary in order for meditative practice to be considered the perfection of meditation.
The opposing force to concentration is distraction, the wavering or distracted mind. We cannot accomplish anything properly if our mind is distracted. Just as a stream of water will overflow and rush off in many directions, if it lacks a suitable conduit, our thoughts flow out in many directions when our mind is distracted. Furthermore, just as water always flows downhill and forms a waterfall unless properly channeled, When our mind is not directed properly, it moves downward in a negative direction, seeking non-virtuous thoughts and actions. Therefore, it is a great fault not to be able to focus the mind properly in this lifetime.
Okay, I'm just going to make a comment here. Excuse me for interrupting you. This is an interesting point he makes here, Apa Rinpoche. And he makes two points, actually. The first one he talks about, uses the example of a stream of water which is overflowing and rushing off in a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. And that's what our thoughts do when we don't direct our mind with meditative concentration. And I think we've all had that experience of our mind just kind of running. And the other point that he makes that I think is kind of interesting is what he calls the movement in the downward direction. Mm-hmm. And we live in what's called the Kali Yuga, which is a kind of a negative period. It's a dark period. And so there is a strong tendency towards negativity in general around us and also in our own mind streams. And if we don't develop meditative concentration, that tendency can slip in and take over and take us in a negative direction. Our founder, Geshe Tashi Namgyo, used to say, it's easy to be negative. And if you think about it, I think he was right. It's easy to be negative. There's a lot of negativity around. You turn on the news, it's full of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we need to realize that there is this tendency to flow like water really all over the place. And it flows in a negative direction if we don't watch out and kind of corral it. So that's right off the bat. Those are two reasons why it's really important to have this perfection.
If we've not been able to achieve concentration properly, we will experience great regret and depression at the time of death. Thus, it is manifestly evident that a distracted mind causes us to undergo great mental suffering. In future lives, too, even if we make the effort to meditate, our mind will easily fall prey to the distraction, and we will not be able to successfully overcome it. Just as it is difficult to halt a river once it starts cascading over a cliff, it will be very difficult for us to curb the habit of distraction in future lifetimes. And if we cannot control distractions in future lifetimes, more and more non-virtuous deeds will accumulate due to the ever-increasing store of defilements and unwholesome deeds. We will be reborn again and again in the lower realms. Further, if we meditate with the wrong view, it will create many obstacles. This is essential to have proper knowledge of the methods of meditation, the goal of meditation, and the view with which we engage in meditation. In this regard, it is narrated, there was once a Hindu practitioner who, after meditating for 12 years on a concept of emptiness, which was not a proper view of ultimate reality, passed away and was reborn as a cat.
Yeah, so...
after all that.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
So, Apa Rinpoche makes the point strongly that it's really important to... learn about meditation and learn how to practice it, learn the different methods of it, learn the goals, and also have the correct view, particularly about emptiness here. Otherwise, even if you're meditating, even for a long time, you can end up with a result which is not what you want. So I think this is a really important chapter in this book. Because obviously when we're talking about Buddhism, we're talking about meditation as one of the main practices of Buddhism. I just realized that I forgot to bring the clock over here. Could you just grab it and just put it there where I can see what time it is so that we have a handle on the time? Thanks a lot. Thank you.
When we go somewhere and mistakenly take the wrong path, our journey will take longer because we'll have to return to the start. In the same way, it is necessary to establish the proper understanding before we embark on the practice of meditation, so that we don't mistakenly follow the wrong path. According to the great Bodhisattva Maitreya, if we know that someone is meditating without having established the proper understanding, we should not criticize him, or her, I guess, or feel that we are in competition with them. Instead, we should extend our compassion to him because he is going the wrong way.
Yeah, so what do you think Aparimsha is talking about here? Any ideas?
Maybe the other schools?
Yeah, which ones?
Other views?
Yeah, which ones?
Hinayana.
Yeah, he's talking about Hinayana, which refers to the motivation of just practicing for yourself, which is not in itself incorrect, because that is a path that Buddha taught. But this is a Mahayana text, and so from a Mahayana point of view, this is not the motivation or the practice that we want, for the simple reason that it takes way, 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 way longer, like 40 countless eons longer to actually reach enlightenment. So it's not an efficient practice. And during that time, when you're in nirvana for all those eons, you're not helping other sentient beings who are suffering. So from a Mahayana point of view, it's considered a wrong path, but never to be criticized.
Right. It is said that if we carry on meditating only on loving kindness or compassion and do not conjoin it with the correct wisdom of ultimate reality, we'll never gain complete freedom from the sufferings. Although the meditation on loving kindness and compassion is a virtuous practice, it is not complete Mayana path unless it is conjoined with the correct view of the ultimate reality. Conversely, if we meditate just on the correct wisdom of ultimate reality without associating it with the great compassion, it will not be a complete Mayana path either. This is because although we can gain a result as the liberation of the lower vehicle, we cannot accomplish the great benefit of others. Therefore, in order to engage properly in the Mayana practice, we must conjoin both compassion and the correct realization of the ultimate state of being. In other words, we must conjoin method and wisdom. With regard to the antidotes for overcoming distractions, there are two kinds. The first method, methods for overcoming the causes of distraction, antidotes to the cause, and methods for overcoming distractions directly, antidotes to the resultant distraction. The first, methods of overcoming the causes of distraction. With regard to overcoming the causes of the distracted mind, we must first identify them. Basically, our mind becomes distracted because of desirous attachment, especially attachment to other beings and to wealth. In order to overcome actual distraction, we must abandon such attachments.
So I think it was last class we talked about the parting from the four attachments teaching. So I'm not going to repeat that tonight, but that's relevant here to go back and really understand what are the attachments, because these attachments are one of the things that cause us distraction in our meditation.
Overcoming attachment to other beings. It's obvious that there are many faults associated with being attached to others. First of all, attachment obstructs us from understanding the sufferings of worldly existence. If we fail to realize that worldly existence is a state of suffering, we won't wish to renounce it. If we become attached to others, we will suffer when we have to part with them. Furthermore, we will fall under their influence. Then instead of using our precious human rebirth, attained with such difficulty for a worthwhile purpose, we will waste our life trying to satisfy the short-term worldly desires of others. This becomes a serious obstacle to attaining the state of enlightenment. Furthermore, the people of this world are very hard to please. They become either happy or unhappy over trifling matters. At certain times, they befriend us, and at other times, they turn into our enemies. When we do nice things for people, the thought of pleasing them, they may become displeased instead. They may even become angry and hate us for it. From all angles, it's extremely difficult to please others. There are many problems in dealing with human beings. Those at lower level become jealous. Those on the same level try to compete with us, and those in higher positions look down on us arrogantly. If we praise people, they become proud. If we criticize them, they become resentful. Regardless of our relationships with others, and irrespective of what we do to help them, we cannot be of any benefit to them at all. It is said that a wealthy person is criticized for what he has, and a poor person is criticized for having nothing. In other words, everybody will be criticized, regardless of his position in life. In one sutra, Buddha stated that of all the inhabitants of this world are concerned only about their own benefit, and they become displeased when they don't get what they want. This being the case, there is no one in the world we can regard as a real friend. Gee. We cannot place any reliance on the people of this world. If we are powerful, people will listen to us and respect us, regardless of what we say, either because they fear us or because they hope to gain some advantage. But once we lose our power, people won't listen to us anymore, however inspiring our speech and however inspiring, and however many favors we have done them in the past. In fact, they'll criticize us. When we are wealthy, there will be lots of friends hanging around, pleased to do whatever they can for us. But when we lose our wealth, they will turn away from us, and we may never see their faces again. Buddha mentioned that although the Buddhist teachings are perfect in every way, some people nevertheless criticize them. Even Buddha himself was criticized during his time on earth. So if we think that we can please everybody and hope that they will like us and look up to us, we are making a big mistake. We will never be able to satisfy the myriad of people in this world, all of whom are constantly seeking different things.
Yeah, here Apa Rinpoche is being kind of mild in his statement when he says the Buddha was criticized during his time on earth. Actually, if you read the sutras, it was much worse than that. He was even subject to an assassination attempt. He went around teaching. People threw mud at him. People threw fire at him. People criticized him and denigrated him and ridiculed him. We see these pictures of the Buddha and it looks like, he's in this blissful state and everything's fine, and I'm sure he was fine and I'm sure he was blissful. But on the outside, he received a lot of negative feedback from people. And he's not the only one. If you look at anybody, anybody who stands up and does anything or says anything is inevitably going to be criticized for it in some way. So we need to recognize that this is the situation, and we shouldn't expect it to be anything other than that.
Right. Okay. At one time, Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who was also considered by ordinary people to be the Buddha's great enemy because became ill and was nearing death, and Buddha went to bless him, and he recovered. When Devadatta was well again, he showed great respect towards Buddha.
Disrespect
towards Buddha by telling him that the only reason he had been able to help him was that he was a capable doctor, and added that because of his medical skills, he would have no problem feeding himself in his old age.
Yeah, so here you have a guy, Devadatta. He's talking to his cousin. He's, you know, on his deathbed with illness. The Buddha saves his life, and all he can say is, well, you're a good doctor and you won't have any trouble making money later on. I mean, that was the extent of his gratitude for having his life saved. So he wasn't even appreciated. Buddha wasn't even appreciated in that circumstance by his own cousin.
Mm-hmm. Also, during the time of Buddha, there was a man by the name of Lepe Karma who told Buddha that a Jain master had gained the state of omniscience and that he was the only one in the world who possessed this quality. Buddha told Lepa Karma that the Jain master would die of indigestion in 7 days' time. And Lepa Karma went back to the Jain master and told him what the Buddha had said. He advised the master to eat very little during the next 7 days to prove Buddha wrong. So the Jain master hardly ate any food for 6 days. However, he miscalculated and thought that the next day, which was actually the seventh day, was the eighth. So he ate a good meal and died of indigestion on the seventh day. He was reborn as a hungry ghost. In the form of this hungry ghost rebirth, the Jain master met Lepe Karma and told him that the Buddha had been correct. Buddha was the real omniscient one, he said. And Lepe Karma should give up his disbelief in Buddha, seek his blessings, and take refuge in him. Nevertheless, Lepe Karma did not like the idea, and he did not develop faith in Buddha. In fact, when he met Buddha later on, he told him that he had been wrong to say that the Jain master would die, because the Jain master had not died. And Buddha replied, not only did your teacher, the Jain master, die within 7 days, but he had actually spoken to you in the form of his rebirth as a hungry ghost. Lepe Karma reported that Buddha was mistaken about the Jain master having been reborn as a hungry ghost, because he had actually been reborn in one of the heavenly realms. And Buddha asked, then who was the hungry ghost you were just talking to? Who told you to come and see me and to have faith in me? At that point, Lepe Karma realized that the Buddha had omniscience. He became highly embarrassed and ashamed about having tried to trick him. Nonetheless, although he now understood that Buddha had the quality of omniscience and could see the future and the state of all beings, he still didn't develop faith in him. Even though he saw the power of the Buddha, he just walked away. This account shows that even though Buddha is completely omniscient and perfectly enlightened, even he cannot satisfy every living being.
Furthermore, do you want to read that?
Sure.
Sure.
We'll give you a break.
Yeah. Okay. Furthermore, Buddha said that we should not be attached even to our loved ones, such as parents or close relatives, because eventually we will have to part with them. When we exit this life, we will be on our own. No one can help us then, not even those who have helped us during this lifetime. Furthermore, it is not appropriate to hate our enemies, because everybody is always changing. Even friends and loved ones can become enemies during this life, not to mention future lifetimes. Here is a story to illustrate this point. There was a couple who had a daughter. The husband was later reborn as a fish, then the wife as a dog. And at one time, the daughter was sitting by the roadside, eating a fish with her baby on her lap. While she was eating, a dog tried to get the bone from her. She beat and kicked the dog as she sat holding the baby, munching the fish and driving the dog away. An Arat passed by. Looking at them through his clairvoyance, he shook his head and murmured to himself that the world was a very strange place indeed. The woman was eating her father, beating her mother, and sitting with her enemy resting on her lap. Thus, we can see how futile it is to become attached to others in this life.
Okay, so that was the first category not to be attached to, which is other beings. And now we're going to go to the second one, which is overcoming the attachment to wealth.
Overcoming attachment to wealth. Another major cause of distraction is attachment to wealth and possessions. In order to accumulate material riches, we engage in non-virtue and encounter great difficulties in all three phases of acquiring things, trying to gain them, having gained them, and then losing them. Suffering is always involved. For example, the time of trying to accumulate wealth, we have to do a lot of difficult things and commit many non-virtuous actions. Sometimes we even have to speak violently. We may cheat others or take advantage of them. In the process, even those who are close to us become our enemies, and our enemies are further alienated. So at every stage of accumulating and guarding wealth, we commit many unwholesome deeds out of the desirous attachment. Therefore, we are unable to travel the path leading to supreme bliss. Once we obtain possessions, we suffer through fear of losing them, and we suffer still more trying to protect them. Our worry about protecting our possessions becomes so great that we become slaves to them. Eventually, instead of being owned by us, they begin to own us. We have to work for them. We create many enemies in our attempts to protect things from others. We fear that others may try to take our things, and we therefore begin to mistrust people. Due to always trying to protect our belongings, we generate negative thoughts and perform negative deeds, which cause our defilements to multiply, leading to never-ending cycle of suffering. Similarly, when we lose things, we become unhappy and displeased with others, and this generates hatred and anger. Consequently, we cannot practice virtue, and our store of merit is soon exhausted. This in turn produces further defilements, sufferings, and non-virtuous deeds. However, this does not mean we have to throw away everything we own. Possessions themselves are not the problem. The fault is with our attachments to them. This is what we need to overcome. So there is no need for you to toss your car keys away right now and catch a bus home. Similarly, we are attached to other living beings. It does not mean there is something wrong with them. The problem lies in our desirous attachment itself. Other people are all right as they are, but we must overcome attachment to them, just as we must overcome or at least reduce our attachment to possessions. This will help us defeat distractions. When it is asked whether we gain any happiness at all through possessions, the answer is that they may bring us some happiness in this life. Indeed, if we lack possessions altogether and our circumstances are extremely poor, we may not have the wherewithal for spiritual practice. However, the faults arising from being attached to them are many indeed. Just as we spread honey on the edge of a sharp knife and then lick it, the pleasure of tasting its sweetness will be nothing compared with the pain of cutting our tongue. Our attachment to people and things is just like that. There is something fleeting pleasure to be had, but along with this, much suffering. Narayana said that when we have an itchy rash on our skin, although there is some pleasure to be had from scratching it, there will be even more pleasure in not having the rash to start with. Similarly, when we are attached to people and things, we may not gain some pleasure, but we may gain far greater happiness by having no attachments from the beginning. Two, methods for overcoming distractions directly. The antidote to a distracted mind is to produce meditative concentration. There are three levels of meditative concentration. One, meditative concentration in common with the worldly. Two, meditative concentration in common with Hinayana. And three, uncommon Mahayana meditative concentration. And here is the sub-point of one. Meditative concentration in common with the worldly. With regard to worldly meditative concentration, there is a preparatory or preliminary stage followed by four actual stages of form realm meditative concentration and four actual states of causes of happiness.
No.
I think you skipped.
Skipped a page there.
Sorry. Nope. So I did. I'm going to begin right at the point again.
Yeah.
Meditative concentration in common with the worldly. With regard to worldly meditative concentration is a preparatory or preliminary stage followed by four actual stages of form realm meditative concentration and four actual states of formless realm meditative concentration. The practitioner should train in these as much as possible. One who is serious about attaining enlightenment and practicing to do so must first engage in these meditative absorptions to the worldly.
Common to the worldly. So Apa Rinpoche just mentions these and lists these here, but he doesn't explain them. And the reason is that later on in chapter 11, there will be more detail about these particular states. So just so you know that they are there, and they'll be talked about later.
Okay. Two, meditative concentration in common with Hinayana. The second meditative concentration is that held in common with the Shravaka Yana. On the Shravaka path, one first contemplates the faults of the world, such as impermanence and suffering. The way to engage in the path common to the Shravakas has two divisions, preparatory meditation and actual meditation. The first, preparatory meditation, depends on the individual. If desirous attachment predominates, one should first meditate on ugliness. If discursive thought predominates, one should begin by concentrating on exhaling and inhaling, counting each inhalation and exhalation as one.
So this refers to something that we talked about several weeks ago, which is the question is sometimes asked, well, I have all these faults or all these problems, where do I start? And the answer usually traditionally that's given is you identify your worst fault or your worst problem and you start with that. Which makes sense if you think about it, because you need to get the biggest problem out of the way so you can go on to these other things. So Apa Rinpoche just gives a couple of examples here about what you need to do. For example, if you're biggest problem is desirous attachment, or if you have a problem with discursive thought, then you need to go find the antidote to those and apply those in your meditation and get the biggest problem kind of under control, and then you can go on and have progress on the path.
Can I ask a question? When he says for desirous attachment, you should meditate on ugliness, can you give some examples of what he means by...
Okay, so this is... this category is concentration in common with the Hinayana. And in the Hinayana, there's a lot of emphasis on morality is kind of the basis of it. And so, for example, if a person is really desirous, that's one of the examples that he uses here. You know, somebody has a kind of an obsession with sexual desire or some kind of desire for something. That's a delusion, because the person has sort of gone overboard with that. And so if you want to counteract that, the traditional meditation for that is to meditate on the impermanence of the body, the impurity of the body, and you go through stages where you visualize the skeleton and the organs and all the impure stuff that's in there. And you lessen your desire, because you've been kind of swamped by your desire and you've kind of gone off the chart with it. And so by counterbalancing that with a meditation on the impure qualities of the body, then your desire will be lessened and it'll be under control. And then, like I said before, then you can deal with the other things because you've gotten the big one out of the way. So that's kind of the classic example that's given. But you can do that with anything. He just did it, in effect, with wealth. He listed all the disadvantages of wealth. You create non-virtue accumulating it. You got to worry about keeping it and worrying about somebody stealing it. And then in the end of the day, you lose it anyway because you die and you can't take it with you. So if you're just totally consumed with money and wealth and that sort of thing, like he said, it's not that there's anything wrong per se with these things. It's the attachment that is the problem. So in other words, you want to apply the antidote, looking at and meditating and realizing the disadvantages of these things that you are so desirous of or attached to, so that you get it under control, so to speak.
So this type of meditation is actually you're thinking it through, you're contemplating. Often people will say, meditation is just not thinking about anything or having any thoughts. This type of meditation is actually really trying to understand your thoughts and trying to understand your desires and really contemplating it.
There's a lot of different kinds of meditation. It's not true that meditation is just not thinking. Right. That's not true.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a misconception.
It's a myth. Yeah.
It's a misconception, especially in the West here. So there is a type of meditation called analytical meditation. Actually, the Dalai Lama talks about this quite a bit, because he said that that's one of his favorite types. So in that kind of meditation, there's traditionally three stages that you go through. The first stage is what's called listening, or in this case, reading, which is the same thing. You're getting the input, you're getting the information. Mm-hmm. Second stage is contemplation. So you think about it, or you discuss it, which is what we're doing now. So what you do is you clarify the information that you listened to or read, and you get it really clear in your mind. Okay, this is what they mean. This is what the meditation is. I need to do this and this and this. Then the third stage is the actual meditation itself. In this case, it would be an analytical meditation. So you go into your concentrative state, meditative concentration.
Like you really think about your desire.
You really think about it, and you really allow it to sink in deep into your bones, that you really understand, there are disadvantages to being attached to people or things. Mm-hmm. And so that it actually goes in and, so to speak, changes your belief system on the core level. You really get it. Okay, it's not a good idea to be attached to that stuff. And so that's what the meditative step does, is it deepens it inside of you so that it isn't just something that you heard or thought about, but that you really believe it and you really live it.
Yeah, and it makes sense. You get on board, kind of.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Right, yeah. Okay, I'll continue here. The second part, the actual meditation, involves meditating on the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment, on the five paths, as follows. The four strongly placed mindfulnesses are cultivated during the path of accumulation. The four correct endeavors are practiced during the level of heat. The first part of the path of joining, the four legs of miracles, are practiced on the second stage of the path of joining. The five spiritual facilities are
faculties
during the level of patience. The third level of the path of joining, the five powers, are practiced during the highest worldly dharma. The eight branches of the Eiras path, or Eightfold Noble Path, are practiced on the path of seeing, and the seven branches or limbs of enlightenment are practiced on the path of meditation. This is a general overview which does not differentiate among the paths of Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and the Mahayana. It is said that there are differences between the Hinayana and Mahayana with regard to the object, the subject, the aspect, and the order of meditating on the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment. But the Hinayanist practice belongs to the Hinayana, and so is omitted here. The five spiritual facilities,
faculties,
refers to the faculty of faith, the faculty of enthusiasm or effort, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. The general characteristic of the five powers is the same as that of the five spiritual facilities, faculties, but they are called the five powers because they cannot be overpowered by their opposing four factors. According to Mahayana, the order of the previously mentioned two is reversed. The seven branches of enlightenment are practiced on the path of seeing, and the eight branches of Aras path, or Eightfold Path, Noble Path, are practiced on the path of meditation.
Okay.
Whoa.
So did you understand all that? There will be a quiz afterwards, so please memorize all that. So I'm not sure why Aparimshri went into such detail there, but don't worry, when we get to chapter 11, this will all be clear. So tune in later.
Okay. Three, uncommon Mahayana meditative concentration. Within uncommon Mahayana, two systems are taught, the mind-only or Cittamatrin
system, Cittamatrin
system, taught according to the explanation given by the great Indian teacher Era Asanga in the Compendium of the Yanas, and the Middle Way tradition taught by Nagarjuna, Ayurveda,
Ayadeva,
and later by Shantideva. The following explanation is according to the instructions to be found in the Bodhicharyavatara by Ara Shantideva.
Okay, so just let's take a breath here. And
I'm looking at my Sanskrit.
So just so we can kind of reset our brains here. In the Mahayana, there are essentially two traditions, the Cittamatrin tradition, which is the mind-only school, and the lineage of that includes Asanga, who you will remember from previous classes, is the person who did 12 years of meditation in order to meet Maitreya, and eventually went to where Maitreya's abode is in the heavens, and received five transmissions and brought them back to earth. One of which is the basis for this text. So this has that tradition to it. But in this case, Sakya Pandita is not going to explain that tradition. He's going to explain the other tradition, which is the Nagarjuna Shantideva tradition. And the really famous text in that tradition is a Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is taught here on Thursday evening and is on Facebook Live on Thursday evening. So if somebody's interested in that, they can go to our Facebook page and listen to those teachings. So those are the two lineages in the Mahayana. We're not going to do Asanga's mind-only tradition. We're going to do Shantideva's tradition. So that's just to kind of set the stage for where we are in the text here tonight.
Meditative concentration according to Middle Way School. According to the Middle Way School, as explained in the Bodhicharya Vyakthicharya, the Mahayana method is to meditate directly on the enlightened thought. However, in order to produce the enlightened thought properly, it is necessary first to meditate on loving kindness and compassion. Although it is not taught in the Bodhicharya Vyakthicharya that one meditates on loving kindness and compassion first, it is necessary to do so in order to produce the enlightened thought.
Just as an aside, I think it's really interesting that Sakya Pandita approaches the chapter on meditative concentration in this way. What do I mean by that? There are a lot of meditation manuals that talk about the what I would call the mechanics of meditation. How to set your posture, what are the downfalls or the hazards, so to speak, of the things that can go wrong when you meditate. What are the antidotes to apply when those things happen? And those meditation manuals kind of teach you, in a sense, kind of the mechanics of meditating, depending on whatever topic that you're meditating on. Sakya Pandita doesn't do that here. He's assuming that you're going to get those instructions from a teacher outside of this text. What he does focus on here is the topic of meditation. What is the object that you're going to meditate on? And how to do it. And that's what he's going to explain now.
Mm-hmm. Meditating on loving kindness. There are three kinds of objects of our meditation on loving kindness. Sentient beings who possess neither happiness nor suffering, in other words, who are neutral in state, those who have not met the noble Dharma, the cause of happiness, and those who, despite having met the Dharma, have not yet attained the qualities of bodhisattvas and buddhas. With regard to the procedure for cultivating loving kindness, we should first meditate on loving kindness towards our parents and relatives. After having cultivated loving kindness towards them, we should practice loving kindness towards our enemies. Then we should cultivate the same benevolent mind towards all sentient beings. The characteristic of loving kindness is to make the wish, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. This refers to happiness free from all defilements and all non-virtues. To have the causes of happiness means not to engage in non-virtuous deeds, which are the causes of unhappiness. In addition, we wish them great happiness and great virtue, which includes the wish that all their deeds be performed through the Mahayana motivation of working for the sake of sentient beings. Initially, we should use words to try to generate this state of mind. It will not actually arise when we first begin, but if we accustom the mind to the concept of generating loving kindness by constant heartfelt repetition of the words, real loving kindness will eventually arise. Not only must we wish for all beings to be in a happy state and to have causes of that happy state, but we must also make the resolve again and again, I must place all sentient beings in a state of happiness and the cause of happiness.
Okay, so this refers back to your question, Tracy, about is meditation just not thinking anything? And he specifically tells you what kind of thought you should have in your analytical meditation on this topic, and he actually gives you the words that you can say to yourself when you're in the meditative state. So that's a perfect example of analytical meditation.
Now, I was so entranced I lost space. I found it, the paragraph. Buddha himself said that the benefits arising from meditating on loving kindness are immense. Even if we were to fill many universes with jewels and offer them to the enlightened beings, the merit from this would not match the merits accrued during a moment's meditation on loving kindness. Therefore, generating loving kindness bestows immeasurable merit and inconceivable benefits upon ourselves and others.
So one of the things that's in the actual root text, which is not in the Dalai Rinpoche's commentary, there are many, many, many quotations which support Sakya Pandita's positions, and he gives scriptural references quite often. And this particular one, I think, is interesting to quote, and I'm going to read it from the root text, and it's from the King of Meditation Sutra, and it's referring to the benefits of cultivating loving kindness. And the sutra says, to offer every day as many sorts of offerings as there would be in 10 million trillions of worlds filled with offerings would not measure up in number or even equal in part to the merit of a single thought of loving kindness.
Wow.
So I'm not exactly sure how many 10 million trillions is, but it's a lot. Worlds. And those offerings don't measure up or even equal the merit of a single thought of loving kindness. So if you put those two things on a scale, you really see how important this loving kindness is in this whole bigger picture of the path, and in particular here in the meditation.
Tracy, do you want to hear it from...
Sure. Two?
Yeah.
Meditating on compassion. To meditate on compassion, we first need to know who should be the objects of our meditation on compassion. According to the teaching by Maitreya, there are 10 types of beings. 1, beings who possess strong desire for beautiful forms, sounds, and smells, the 5 objects of desire. 2, beings obstructed by engaging in spiritual deeds by enemies, such as Maras and so on. 3, sentient beings of the lower realms. 4, those who perform non-virtues continuously, such as butchers. 5, those who've embarked on the path which is difficult to travel. This refers to sentient beings who, according to Chittamatra teachings, will never be liberated from cyclic existence. 6, those who possess great fetters which bind them to samsara. This refers to the non-Buddhist Indian sectarians. 7, those who have attachment to the form and formless realm, meditative absorption, which is like being attached to great food mixed with poison. If one consumes such food, one will have a short period of pleasure and soon afterwards will suffer and die. The Hindu practitioners who involve themselves in austerity, such as jumping from rocks, jumping into water, entering fires, and so forth. That was the 8th. 9, the Hinayana practitioners, not because they are on the wrong path, but because they are on the longer path. Even though the paths of Shravakas and Pratyabuddhas are causes of Buddhahood, because theirs is the crooked way. They have that in quotes. They are also objects of Mayana compassion. And 10, beginner bodhisattvas, just embarking on the spiritual path, who have not yet cultivated enough merit or produced correct wisdom. Maitreya also explained another way to categorize the objects of meditation on compassion. That is, in terms of the six classes of people who engage in conduct opposite to the practice of the six perfections. According to this system, the objects of compassion are those who are miserly, those who break their vows of morality, those who are short-tempered, those who are lazy, those who have distracted minds, and those who are strongly attached to wrong views. Sri Maitreya taught that the objects of our meditation on compassion may be divided broadly into two groups. The first consists of those who are in cyclic existence, and the second consists of those who strive to gain personal liberation and have fallen into the extreme nirvana. The first group has two divisions. One, sentient beings who engage in the causes of suffering, and two, sentient beings who are experiencing the resultant suffering. One, sentient beings who engage in the causes of suffering. This includes those who consistently commit non-virtuous deeds in order to collect wealth or to gain personal happiness in this life. Acting in such an improper manner, they accumulate the causes of further suffering. They will definitely face sufferings in the lower realms during future lives. Can you describe what might be a person that is continuing to create non-virtuous deeds? Is that just generally just somebody that's just making really bad decisions in their life, or is that someone that's really wanting to harm someone, or
well both like he uses the example of people that are obsessed with collecting wealth, and he referred earlier on about people that will lie, steal, kill, you know, for money, and they'll, you know, you think of somebody that's involved in, you know, I lived in Italy, so I think of the mafia, you know, those people, they practice non-virtue as a lifestyle. I remember listening to an interview of a mafia assassin, and he talked very matter-of-factly about getting his hit list for the day, and he would go out, drive to the next town, kill a couple people, come back, you know, have a coffee. That was his job, was to kill people. So, and he did it on a daily basis, and he didn't even think about it. That's a massive accumulation of non-virtue, of course. Right. He was like a professional non-virtuous.
Yeah, okay. So that's like a real extreme of somebody that is committing non-virtuous acts on a continuous basis.
Yeah, it's an extreme example, but, you know, on a lesser level, we all do non-virtue pretty much continuously without even necessarily realizing it.
Really. Okay. All right. Two, okay. Sentient beings who are experiencing the resultant suffering. So would those be those same people that are committing these non-virtuous acts could also be the people that are experiencing the resultant suffering too?
Well, he explains it. Let's read it and you'll see what he means.
This includes beings in the lower realms and even those who are experiencing suffering in the higher realms, such as human beings who live in poverty, who have diseases or mental distress, who are separated from relatives and loved ones, who have encountered enemies, who are aging, who live in fear, or who are despised by those of higher status. Bodhisattvas also take beings in the second also take beings in the second broad group who strive to gain personal liberation and who have fallen into extreme nirvana. As objects of compassion, since they will have a great difficulty to attaining the state of full and perfect enlightenment. This is because they have followed the path of the delayed diversion, and it will therefore take 40 great eons longer for them to attain complete enlightenment than ordinary beings who engage in the Mayana path from the beginning. With regard to the method of generating compassion, compassion arises as a result of seeing suffering and reflecting upon it. If we visualize others in a state of suffering again and again and meditate on it, we will develop compassion. We should examine the condition of other beings carefully and see the extent to which they have fallen into the three different types of suffering. The suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, and the suffering of all conditioned existence, which pervades all cyclic existence. In addition, we should rely on a spiritual teacher to give us teachings about the methods of arousing compassion. When we see the various states of suffering, meditate on them and receive as many teachings as we can from our spiritual friend. It will be easier for us to generate compassion appropriately. One who has already generated compassion, either in a previous life or in this lifetime, will find it quite easy to generate compassion again now. The method of meditating on compassion is first to focus on someone you love very much, such as your mother, your child, or someone else who is very close to you. Then using this person as your object of meditation, produce a feeling of compassion. It's necessary to use someone close and dear to you because it's easy to produce compassion when you think of someone who brings you happiness. If you begin by trying to practice compassion towards your enemies, you may experience revulsion instead, and the mind will become an infertile ground for producing compassion towards them now and in the future. Compassion may be defined as the mental state which wishes the other being or beings to be free from suffering and its causes. The causes of suffering are emotional defilements and not virtuous deeds, which originate from clinging to I and viewing it as real. With this understanding, we should make the compassionate aspiration, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes, especially clinging to the I, the root cause of all suffering.
So in the root text, Sakya Pandita goes into a little bit more detail on this section, so I think it might be interesting just to read that. So he says, how to cultivate compassion entails a description of three methods. The first is the non-Buddhist method of cultivating compassion, which takes a person as its object with the wish, may these sentient beings who are permanent, single, and independent become free from suffering, which is permanent, single, and independent. The second is the Shravaka's method of cultivating compassion, which takes the factors of existence as its object with the wish, wouldn't it be wonderful if these sentient beings who are merely an assemblage of factors, namely personality aggregates, sensory bases, and elements, became free from suffering, which is merely an assemblage of factors? These first two ways of cultivating compassion are not cultivated by practitioners of the Mahayana because they conflict with discerning wisdom and emptiness. The third way of cultivating compassion is the Bodhisattva's method, which is called non-objectified great compassion, or also called non-referential compassion. This is generated through the wish. Wouldn't it be wonderful if these sentient beings, who are like an illusion, were freed of both the causes of suffering and suffering itself, which are like illusions? Mm. So those are the three methods in the root text.
Are we on number three?
With regard to the benefits, page 91.
With regard to the benefits of practicing compassion, it is stated in the,
Just read the English.
Okay. The Compendium of a Doctrine Sutra, that Arya Avalokiteshvara addressed Shakyamuni Buddha in the following terms. Blessed one, a bodhisattva need not train in many practices. If the bodhisattva has realized and adhered to one practice, then all Buddha's qualities will be in the palm of his hand. What is that one practice? The great compassion. That is why all the temporary and ultimate benefits of Mahayana practices arise from compassion. It is also explained in the following way in the Entering the Middle Way. In the beginning, compassion leads to altruistic practices of Mahayana. In the middle, when one is trained on the paths, compassion protects practitioners from falling into the Hinayana path. So is that the Hinayana view they're saying? The Hinayana motivation,
which is, I'm just doing this for myself because I'm really want to get out of samsara.
Okay. Finally, after accomplishing complete Buddhahood, it is through compassion that Buddha continues his activities to benefit sentient beings. 3. Meditation on the enlightenment thought. Next, we meditate on the enlightenment thought. And there are two ways to meditate on the enlightenment thought. 1. Sameness of self and others. And 2. Exchanging self for others.
Actually, in the root text, there are three. And the third one is the method for perfecting those first two. So we'll see if we can get into that later on.
Okay. Sameness of self and others. With regard to meditating on the sameness of self and others, as it is taught by the Bodhicharya Avatara, one should initially strive diligently to cultivate the equality of self and others by thinking all sentient beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. I should protect other sentient beings as I would protect myself, and we should also resolve I myself will bestow happiness on all living beings. And I myself will free sentient beings from suffering. When any happiness comes to us, we should wish, may all sentient beings attain the same kind of happiness I'm experiencing now. Whenever we experience suffering, we should wish, may all sentient beings be free from the kind of suffering I'm experiencing now. In this way, we can equate ourselves with other beings. We should meditate again and again on the equality of self and others until it becomes a firm conviction. Once our mind becomes accustomed to the thought of equating ourselves with others, we can begin to meditate on the exchanging of self for others.
Exchanging self for others. There are two ways to meditate on exchanging self for others. A, the extensive method, and B, the brief method. A, the extensive method of exchanging self for others. When we come across someone who is our superior, we often become jealous. We imagine that he mistreats us, lacks compassion for us, and looks down on us, that he criticizes us and blames us when things go wrong. We feel competitive towards those on the same level and try to prevent them from surpassing us. We look down on those at the lower level, thinking that they need not be treated as equals. In such ways, we generate feelings of jealousy, competitiveness, and pride towards those who are above us, on the same level or below us, respectively. In order to practice the meditation of exchanging self for others, we have to alter the way we think about these three categories of people. With meditation to those who evoke our jealousy, the method to overcome it is to imagine exchanging our position with other persons, placing ourselves in the high position and the other below us. Then we practice arousing jealousy towards this other person who is actually us. When we see the negative consequences of this, we will give up the idea and stop feeling jealous of that person. Therefore, to cultivate the meditation on competitiveness towards those of equal status, we visualize ourselves in their place and visualize the enemy of equal status in ours. Then we visualize the enemy who is now in our place, competing against us in every possible way. After completing this meditation, we should think, if I experience such suffering merely through visualizing myself as the enemy of equal status competing with the enemy, now in my place, how can it be acceptable for me to compete against others? In this way, our competitive mind will pacify itself. One should apply the same process to pride. Generally, we feel pride towards people of inferior status, inferior race, lower morality, lower practices, inferior physical form, lower economic position, and so forth. In this visualization, we put the person of the lower status in our place. Then we visualize him generating pride towards us. He now becomes conceited about his excellent qualities compared with us, now in the lower status. After completing the meditation, we should think, excuse me, if I experience such suffering merely by meditating that others act in a conceited way towards me, I'm going to ask you to carry forward.
Sure. How dare I even feel conceited towards others? In this way, our mind will pacify conceit towards those of lower status. The entire method of exchanging self for others with these three sets of people are explained in detail in the 8th chapter of the Bodhicharya Avatara.
Yeah, so this is kind of a fairly complicated meditation, and like he says, it's explained in great detail in the 8th chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which, as I said before, is taught on Thursday. So if you really want to go into detail in this meditation, tune in on Thursdays.
The brief method of exchanging self for others. The short method for exchanging self for others is to visualize that we give ourselves happiness and virtue to all living beings and take upon ourselves all the suffering, non-virtue, and unhappiness experienced by others. We think, may all my happiness and virtue ripen upon others, and may all the suffering, unhappiness, and non-virtue of others ripen on me. So you're not really thinking of specifics like you were in the previous explanation. This is more of a general.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah.
This is one of the ways of practicing the exchanging enlightenment thought. Nagarjuna stated that if we could give form to the merit arising by simply thinking just for one moment about exchanging self for others, it would be vaster than the skies of all the three realms of existence.
Actually, the actual quote is, it would be greater than all the sands in the river Ganges.
Oh, wow. Wow. This method for accomplishing this meditation on the exchanging enlightenment thought is to meditate again and again on this thought in order to gain the state of full and complete enlightenment. After meditating again and again on this thought of exchanging ourselves for others, we will be able to accomplish the real meditation on the enlightenment thought. To achieve this, it is necessary to see the disadvantages of working for our own benefit and to understand the great benefit of working for others.
So, this is a kind of an advanced kind of meditation, if you think about it. You know, the idea of exchanging yourself for others, you know, I'm going to take on their suffering. And in the root text, Sakyapandita addresses a common objection to this kind of meditating. And I think it's worth reading the root text here, because this is something that people think about. They think, well, I want to be happy. I don't want to be taking other people's suffering on. You know, who wants that? And so there might be some resistance to this kind of meditation. So Sakyapandita writes, regarding the above practice, some people may object, doubting that they would be able to bear the suffering of all sentient beings if those sufferings all came to them. This is not a substantial objection. Meditating as above is like one dog chasing after another, or like dirt cleaning another impurity.
Nice. Like you're going to have the power, it's all going to come on you.
In other words,
you think so highly of us.
In other words, it is as if, just after drawing close to wild birds and animals, you were to shout, "Everyone assemble in front of me," that they would all scatter. Similarly, by uttering the words, "May the suffering of all sentient beings come to me," the suffering of yourself and others will be destroyed, but they will not actually be experienced. And then he gives some other examples. So what he's saying is, this is a kind of a common objection, but there's nothing to be afraid of. If you call forth the suffering of other beings onto yourself, you will not actually have to experience the suffering of other beings. It's about transforming your mind and your attitude. That's what it's about. And he gives a couple of examples, one of which is from the Jataka Tales. Jataka Tales, if you remember, are the stories of the Buddha's previous lifetimes before he became enlightened. And in one of those stories, the Buddha was actually reborn in a hell realm. And in that hell realm, he was yoked to a cart, and there was another guy next to him yoked to the same cart. And they were pulling this cart through fire, and they were being whipped and beaten as they were having to do this. And the Buddha looked over to the guy next to him and saw this poor guy suffering and saw him being beaten and whipped and everything. And he had the thought, oh, wow, that's really, really terrible. I wish that his suffering would come on to me so that he could be free. And as soon as he had that thought, he was freed from hell and he was born in the heaven, the God realms in the heaven. So it was the power of that altruistic thought of wishing the suffering come to him. He, in fact, didn't receive the suffering. He received the benefit of it, and he got out of the hell realm and was born in the heavenly realm. Wow. So that's one of the examples that Sakyapandita mentions here in the root text.
That's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, yeah.
We should constantly examine our state of mind. In other words, we should develop
I think we skipped a paragraph. Go up to in order to.
Oh, I'm sorry. In order to stabilize this enlightenment thought, we must examine very carefully the real purpose and benefit behind it. Then we'll understand that we have been working solely for our own benefit for many lifetimes, never thinking of benefiting other sentient beings. This has led to the suffering we are experiencing now. As long as we continue to seek only our own happiness, we'll never gain the happiness we have always wanted. Instead, we will gain only more and more suffering. When we understand that only through working for the benefit of others can we gain real happiness, we will appreciate the purpose of developing the enlightenment thought.
Okay. So I want to just stop reading for a moment and see if there's any comments or discussion that anybody has. We read quite a bit tonight, and we've already talked about a few of the points, but is there any, before we close here, are there any comments anybody wants to make?
I wanted to read out what the enlightenment thought was again, because it's referred to so often. Can we read just the general...
Where is that?
The Great Enlightenment Thought on page 17.
Page 17.
Yeah. Well, they're talking about generating the enlightenment thought all quite often, and I thought it would be helpful if we...
Yeah. Do you find that?
Yeah. So, broadly speaking, the enlightenment thought refers to an intention to attain enlightenment. This is similar to what happens when we decide to embark on a journey, and we must have the intention to take the trip before we actually embark on it. So I find that's helpful for me, at least, if I'm always hearing enlightenment thought, well, what is that? So always bring your intention back. Why are you doing this? You know, what's the purpose? I just wanted to share that.
And I would add, for the benefit of all sentient beings. Yeah. And that makes it the Mahayana Great Enlightenment thought. That's what we call, that's the bodhicitta, the mind of, Lama calls it the enlightenment thought, that's the English, but it's very often referred to as bodhicitta. Bodhicitta has a very extensive explanation, of course, behind it, but in simple terms, the thought to attain enlightenment in order to free all the beings that are suffering that have been your mothers.
So you just keep coming back to it, coming back to it, coming back to it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's still more to go in this chapter, and we'll continue the next time, which will not be next week because there's a special meditation here at the center that we do. Actually, there are two of them that we do here, and they are scheduled according to the lunar calendar, not the sun calendar. And so that means it's a different time every month. And as it turns out, one of those meditations will be next Friday. So we won't be doing this Sage's Intent broadcast. We'll be doing that meditation. But 2 weeks from now, we'll be back and we'll continue with the chapter on meditative concentration. So we'll conclude with our dedication prayers. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise is supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future.
I dedicate all sentient beings.
I dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever meaning virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you, Michael.
Tuchina.
Thank you, Michael.